This is Car Expert.
Mitsubishi and Volkswagen and Nissan really are now falling well behind Kia, and I expect that gap to kind of grow as time goes by.
I'm about 10 laps in the i20M. I'm turning in so much later. I'm braking so much later.
In terms of the value proposition, I would say that the Yaris GR is probably the best value Yaris that's in the local range.
G'day, my name's Mandy Turner, and hello to Mike Costello.
Hey, Mandy.
And James Wong.
Hi.
Hello.
We are always encouraging anybody who listens to the podcast to let us know what you think of the show. And we had an interesting question come through at podcast@carexpert.com.au from John Paul. He said, "Hi, team. Love the podcast. I want to ask you thoughts on Toyota move in selling the Gazoo Racing Yaris Edition for $10,000 less than the asking price. My opinion on this is skeptical, as I think the original asking price was a fake advert attempt to help the pre-sale go like hotcake. Really, would you be buying this car next year knowing it's $10,000 more? I don't think so. What are your thoughts on this marketing attempt?"
Well, I don't think that it is necessarily a made-up price, purely because what's a top-of-the-range Yaris hybrid, Wongy? It's about 35 grand, right?
And we spoke about this
when the new Yaris launched. The new Yaris is an incredibly expensive light car, and to its fairness, it's a high-quality, incredibly safe, well-equipped one, but it is very expensive. So the idea that the Yaris GR, by extension, would be incredibly expensive, considering it's a low-volume car with huge changes made to the chassis and the engine and every other bit
and produced in Europe, mind you.
Yeah, so I think it is probably understandable that it would wear such a high, you know, 50-ish price. And in fact, throughout the entire lead-up to the launch of the car, all the speculation and all of the hints that we were getting with it, it was going to be much more expensive than most of its size competitors. But there is no doubt that the move to slash 10 grand off the price or even more and make it 40 grand drive away has clearly burned a hole in Toyota's pocket. The company is not making money on that, I can guarantee you that. What it's done is it's used that as a marketing spend. So that X amount of $1 million that it loses or doesn't earn, I should say, by selling the car for cheap, basically replaces a conventional marketing spend. And so instead it can lure in 1,000 hardcore devotees that become the best ambassadors that they could possibly hope for. The challenge, of course, from here is how the hell do you convince somebody who missed out on the first 1,000 or so to ever pay 50 grand? And that's going to be the challenge. And to be honest with you, I don't see how they will. They've got the rally version coming, which is the special edition that has diffs at either end and different rubber and lightweight wheels and all that. And they might be able to get that money for that. But there's no way that they're going to be able to convince anybody to shell out so much more money for the same car. So they might have made a rod for their own back there. And it's going to be really interesting to see whether they have to walk that back. And I suspect they probably will.
Well, I think it's a really interesting ploy, as you said as well. My view on it is that we have to stop looking at it as a Fiesta or Polo competitor, because if you actually spec up a Volkswagen Polo GTI, you're actually going to be approaching 40 grand drive away anyway, retail. So I kind of see the Yaris GR as something similar to what the previous generation Focus RS was a few years ago. You know, that was typically a Golf or Civic competitor in terms of the performance end of things, but because it was just so good and it was so focused, it was commonly compared with higher end hatches from the class up, so maybe like an RS3 or a Mercedes-AMG A45. That was something that many journalists across the world have, the comparison that they've drawn. So in terms of, yes, this car is based on a Yaris, and the Yaris is already quite expensive, and, you know, this one being a bespoke car with three doors, a carbon roof, and all this other stuff that they've got on it, obviously that's going to bump it up. I think it's also a really good way of getting people to actually try it first, and, like, you know, you say, this is how much we're thinking of selling it for. If you buy it at this, it'll give us the opportunity to bring more cars over. They can now justify bringing over the one with all the rally edition with all the performance pack stuff that was initially off the cards for our market. And then I think maybe you might, as you said, Moko, you might see the rally edition become a permanent fixture in the model tree, being a 50 grand proposition. And then, you know, they just announce 100 more units of the normal one for 44,950 drive away. So a little bit more than the original promotion, but still a little bit less than retail. So it'll be maybe a bit of a seesaw thing for them, where they have to find that balance between keeping the price attractive but also making sure they're not losing too much money on it. But I think, you know, they can by having that many of them on the road and having people actually being interested enough to buy one and then drive and say how good it is, I think it can only be a good thing, because if they sell 1,000 units within the first year, they've already outsold the Fiesta ST. And so, you know, it's an interesting strategy for sure, but I think that it's something that's going to work for them. And in terms of the value proposition, I would say that the Yaris GR is probably the best value Yaris that's in the local range, even though it's the most expensive. So, you know, I love the idea of having a rally homologation special. I've always, you know, growing up in the 90s, you always had those, you know, road going Le Mans race cars and rally car specials and things like that that you used to see on posters or video games and whatever. And this is really the first car, maybe since the last generation Focus RS, that kind of continues that tradition. Because even though, like, the latest Volkswagen Golf GTI TCR is meant to be based on the race car, it's still just sort of like a hotted up normal one rather than like an all out wide body special thing. So that's, I think I'm just so obsessed with this, the Yaris GR as a concept, because it's affordable, but it's got like racing tech. It's a bespoke thing under a production car shell. I just think it's so cool. And the fact that so many people are interested in it can only be a good thing. Let's hope that we see more cars from Toyota like this, and also more cars from other manufacturers that are like this as well.
Time for you to flog the GDI Golf and pick up a Yaris GR, I reckon.
I'll have to test drive one first. Maybe I can go to like a media launch or a track day and sample one before I make that kind of decision. Then I'll wrap it in green or something.
Well, I'm just going to say it needs to be in green, otherwise you won't buy it.
Yeah, exactly. Imagine like an acid green Yaris, like a four-wheel drive poison apple or something. I don't know.
I might have to have a think and see whether we can get a representative from Toyota Australia on the podcast at some point and have a chat about this and the current Toyota lineup. It might be worth chasing up. All right, let's get into this week's podcast. JWO, the 2021 BMW 128 Ti has been revealed. What are your thoughts on this car?
Yes, well, we covered the very thinly camouflaged prototype not long ago, and BMW has finally officially revealed the new 128 Ti, which revives a very special naming structure for the brand. They've had a lot of TIs in the past, dating all the way back to the 1960s BMW 1800 Ti and 2002 Ti. And now
what's
they're
the TI stand for? Do we know?
Turismo Internazionale. I would say it with my hands and do an Anthony Crawford job, but you can't see me. It's not a video podcast. So basically what this car is meant to be, it sits between the normal 1 Series range and then the flagship 135i X Drive. There's so many like long-winded names that they have in their range, but it's if you kind of look at the 1 Series as something similar to like a Volkswagen Golf or Ford Focus competitor in mainstream terms, you've got the 128 Ti, which is meant to be like a GTI or an ST competitor. It's in that it's front-wheel drive, but still a high-power four-cylinder engine with, you know, a front mechanical diff for extra grip and, you know, more focus on delivering driver engagement for enthusiasts. And then you have that M135i X Drive with all-wheel drive, even more power, but still kind of a GT sort of thing because it's a bit heavier, so it's not specifically for track use, and it's meant to be an all-rounder. So what they've done here is basically put a more powerful 2-litre petrol engine than they have in the normal range. So it's a 195 kilowatt and 400 newton metre version of that engine. You get a little bit more in the all-wheel drive 135i X Drive, but obviously you've got that extra traction on the rear axle. So it's still pretty quick. It claims to hit 0 to 100 kilometers an hour in 6.1 seconds, which is no slouch, even though some people would be like, it doesn't do sub 5 seconds. Like, it's not fast. It's still pretty fast. And it can hit a top speed of 250 kilometers an hour. And being tuned for driver engagement and, you know, that purist sort of feel, there's a lot of under the skin improvements that have and that are sharpening it up for like track use or just, you know, more fun on a twisty back road. So you get things like a mechanical torsion slip differential on the front axle. You've got higher performance M Sport brakes with red calipers. You get light alloy wheels in Michelin Pilot Sport 4 tyres. And the suspension is a bespoke setup that has been lowered by a few millimetres compared to the standard car. And compared to the all-wheel drive version of the M135i, it's about 80 kilograms lighter. So it's just meant to be, you know, more of a driver's car. So it's going to be coming here in the first quarter of next year. They haven't said how much it's going to cost, but considering it sits between the standard one series range and the M135i, it should start somewhere between 50 and 60 grand.
Okay.
So,
I had a look at some of the comments on that actual article, and quite a few of our readers aren't a fan of the looks. What do you think of it?
I really like the new one series from the back. I think that it's quite wide and low and angular. And then you get around to the front and it's just the nose is just – it doesn't really match up with the rear. I think that from the B-pillar backward, it's very – or even the A-pillar backward, it's very sporty. It's got a sloping roof line. It's quite low. There's sharp creases. And then you get to the front and it's too rounded and high set. And it just – yeah, I don't know. It's just a bit of a disjointed design front to rear for me. I think that it's kind of similar to the last one series, isn't it? Because the first model had a really weird snout, but like quite a nice rear. And then they fixed up the front with the midlife update. So I'm assuming they might do that again when this one heads for a midlife refresh and give it like a lower, wider nose with sharper headlights and a smaller grille to make it look a bit sportier. I guess if you're driving one of these, you don't have to look at it, which might help. But I do agree with a lot of the comments saying that the front looks a bit funny and then the back looks all right. So it'll be interesting to see. I've seen quite a few of them on the road, so people are still buying them. But it's not a supermodel.
This is such an exciting car to me because the 125i or the 130 or the 128, the historical mid-level point of the 1 Series range was always Golf GTI-ish but kind of had the fundamentals right. But this one goes the extra mile, right, because it's got the LSD and it's got a lot of the racing accoutrement on it that the previous sort of iterations didn't. And BMW is actually committed to making a proper Tier 2 hot hatch out of the 1 Series, which I think it always should have done. So looks aside, this car really stacks up, you know, in terms of power and in terms of performance, at least on paper. And that price, if it's 55 grand, that's pretty compelling to me because a BMW is still something to covet. And if it can be competing with the Civic Type R or the Megane RS or the Golf R on price, but you get a BMW badge with it, man, I reckon this thing could end up being pretty popular.
For sure.
Good points. All right, moving on. Marco, Mazda has ruled out a twin to the 7-seater 2021 Isuzu MU-X.
Yeah, so obviously Mazda had a divorce from Ford and turned to Isuzu Ute to develop the new BT50 pickup, which is a restyled pickup that is essentially mechanically identical to the D-Max, same chassis and same engine. Now, Isuzu is quite successful with the MU-X, which is the 4x4 wagon derivative of the D-Max, and it's going to be a heck of a lot better than the predecessor model because, of course, the new D-Max is so much more sophisticated inside, better materials, more safety tech, bigger touchscreen, all of that, that the MU-X will obviously move up as well and become not just a sort of Prado or Everest rival on price, but also on quality and tech. Unfortunately, though, this supply deal for Mazda with Isuzu is strictly limited to the BT50 D-Max Utes. There's no agreement in place to make an MU-X. Now, it's unclear whether Mazda never requested for Isuzu to make an MU-X for it and rebadge it as a Mazda, or whether Isuzu was unwilling to do it. But either way, whatever the actual politics involved are, there won't be a body-on-frame, hardcore, rugged, 4x4-focused Mazda SUV to sit alongside that more soft CX-9, which, you know, you have to say that is a market that Mazda could probably do quite well in, considering that Toyota Prado and Fortuna, Ford Everest, Isuzu MU-X, Mitsubishi Pajero Sport, they're all very big selling vehicles. Mazda has absolutely nothing to compete in that market. So I suspect if Mazda Australia could have had the opportunity, it probably would have, but it's just not to be, unfortunately. I think you know, it's kind of strange in a way because Mazda's branding of the BT50 in terms of having a bit more of a plush interior, a sort of more car-like front end than the Isuzu equivalent would really work quite well on an SUV. So in actual fact, I think the Mazda treatment of the BT50, if they were to apply that logic over to a derivation of the MUX, would actually make more sense than the Ute does. So I'm a little bit surprised perhaps to hear this, although clearly there aren't as many sales to be had in SUVs as there are in Utes, which probably had something to do with the business case. But yeah, bit of a shame.
I feel opinion piece coming along, Moko.
I just actually had a little brainwave just then as well, speaking on that topic. I think you have to look at it this way. Like with Mazda, they've contracted another company to basically develop this car for them, and then they've spent obviously a lot of money to reskin it and also do some bespoke interior appointments. And then if you enter a seven-seat SUV version in the same segment that it already has two cars which are developed and designed in-house, I guess maybe they're trying to avoid any sort of competition between a product that has their branding on it but also is being contracted by somebody else, if that makes sense. They already have a seven-seat diesel SUV in the CX-8, and then they also have the CX-9, which is petrol-powered. So I guess for them, it's like, you know, most of our customers want a passenger, like, you know, a luxurious passenger style experience. So maybe we'll just stay with a CX-8 and CX-9, because what are you going to call a BT50-based Mazda SUV? Is it going to be like a CX-8.5, a CX-BT50? You know what I mean? It would just be such a random, you know, you're not going to call it a CX-7 because then you're trashing the lineage of that badge by having, you know, it used to be a turbocharged sporty SUV and now it's this ladder frame SUV. I think it would perhaps get too confusing. And then maybe, as you say, Moko, they like having that more luxurious premium interior and driving experience where they may not be able to deliver that on something that's a bit more rugged. So, you know, a Mazda buyer that wants an SUV isn't necessarily going to consider an off-roader like a BT50 based one.
You call it the BT70, mate, and you're done.
CX10 is the next number up, isn't it?
Indeed.
All right. Now, Melbourne's due to get a Genesis studio this year, like the boutique-style showroom already in Sydney, but understandably, like everything else, COVID-19 got in the way of its design and construction plans. It has now been pushed back to early 2021. Opening this year, it would have been good timing for when the BMW X5 rival, the GV80, is set to be released in the coming months. Looking at some sales figures here, last year to October, just 84 Genesis cars were sold, with this year on the improve slightly to 127. Marco, I'd be keen to get your thoughts. What do you reckon the introduction of the GV80 will do for Genesis?
Well, it kind of feels like Genesis has really been spinning its wheels a little bit. The G70 and the G80 are both decent sort of cars, but they're sedans. And the reality is the luxury market is overwhelmingly SUV dominated now. And Genesis only had, I mean, Wongy, you can probably tell me, but as far as I know, it's only got one boutique in New South Wales as it stands. It's
correct,
obviously
yeah.
Planning to greatly expand its presence. And I won't say dealer network because they're not conventional franchise dealers. They're in-house, you know, Hyundai-owned facilities. But without, you know, SUVs and without any real showrooms to speak of, bar one, you're not going to be able to sell too many cars. And even though they do online sales and things like that, it's still not going to be easy to get that market penetration they need. But as you move into next year and you start getting the new product coming, there are a couple of SUVs on the horizon and there's an updated G70 on the horizon, all due next year as far as I understand it. If you can start rolling out showrooms in capital cities to capitalize on that, it would be very simple to see Genesis kind of go up in sales massively on a percentage basis, because from a low base, it's quite easy to grow rapidly. So I could see next year, you know, Genesis being the fastest growing car brand in Australia. Now, that doesn't mean that it's going to be selling 20,000 cars a year, but it's certainly going to be doubling or tripling or quadrupling what it's doing at the moment, purely because what it's doing at the moment is kind of nowhere. It's going to be interesting to see in the long run whether Genesis becomes the next Infiniti, which was Nissan's attempt at a luxury brand that fell flat on its face. And, you know, they've given that brand the arse in Australia already, or whether, like Lexus, it grows it and builds it up with time and becomes a genuine contender to the Germans. I tend to think the latter because, you know, Hyundai is nothing if not determined, but it's going to be super interesting to see. But I think it's only going to get better for Genesis from here, and it couldn't get a lot worse.
Because on paper, these new models actually look pretty good. So once we get a chance to drive
them.
There's
nothing wrong with the cars. They're quite distinctive looking, very interesting exteriors, very high-tech interiors, beautiful quality. Always with luxury brands, half of the challenge isn't so much the product itself, but it's the image around it. You know, you buy a luxury car not because you need one, but because you covet one, right? So they have to make Genesis desirable. But, you know, I think they're doing the right things. They just have to be patient enough to sort of stay the course.
Yeah. Yep. Fair enough. There was a leak this week for the 2022 Subaru BRZ, and it looks like it's not going to be turbocharged. And I hear all hot car fanatics go, "Oh,
no, hallelujah, hallelujah!"
I agree, actually.
Yeah, well, I'm struggling to keep up with this BRZ and 86 stuff because I feel like we've been talking about this for a very long time. Like I can remember, all of us in previous lives have been speaking about this car for a while, and now we're still going on with leaks and teasers and reports and all this kind of nonsense. But over the past week, there's been a leak of a camouflage car in some sort of promotional shoot scene thing. Apparently, it's meant to be shown in Subaru BRZ guys in the Northern Hemisphere's fall. So, you know, probably in the next few months, and then production starting in spring. And apparently, it's only going to be a non-turbocharged version of the 2.4-litre boxer engine that does service in turbocharged guys in the US market Subaru Ascent SUV, which is sort of like a spiritual successor to the Tribeca that used to be sold here. I know a little bit about the Tribeca because my parents actually used to own one, so we were one of like five people to have one in all of Australia. So it was
the world's least fuel efficient car.
Really? Only one of them, which is why it had to go from the family garage. But so what this means is that it will likely continue to be very much an enthusiast sort of similar to like the MX-5. And I think maybe that's what Subaru and Toyota are gunning for. You know, they've already got the Supra and now the Yaris GR, which are very high performance, very 0-100 and track time based cars, whereas the BRZ and the 86 have historically been all about fun factor. And like the Mazda MX-5, it's very much like, you know, it's free revving, relatively high output, naturally aspirated petrol engine with the availability of rear-wheel drive and a manual transmission, and just making sure that it's a very traditional compact car that's not so focused on being everything for everyone, but rather satisfying the kind of person that wants a weekend fun to drive sort of thing. So the claim or the leaks suggests that this engine is going to be making 162 kilowatts of power and 240 newton meters of torque, which is a little bit up on the current models, 152 kilowatts and 212 newton meters, but obviously quite a bit below the turbocharged Subaru Ascent's 190 kilowatts and 375 newton meters. So, but I think what makes the 86 and BRZ so loved at the moment is the fact that it offers that very pure driving experience, and that's probably what I think Toyota and Subaru are really gunning for here. It's all about keeping those enthusiasts happy and not messing with a formula that has proven very successful for them.
So I think, you know, I get a little bit tired of hearing enthusiasts out there constantly chastising the 86 and BRZ for being underpowered, but at the same time venerating the Honda S2000 and VTEC Atmo Honda engines of the 90s or Mazda rotaries or, you know, things like that, where they're engines that need you to really rev them. They're engines that beg to be driven hard. They're engines that give you an instant hit of power, but to get peak torque, you've actually got to be approaching redline. They're vehicles that scream and yell and carry on, and that is what a naturally aspirated engine is all about today. I'm so sick of these turbo engines that have got torque bands that are incredibly plateaued, and they're incredibly responsive, and their rolling response is good, and their economy is good, but they don't sound any good. They don't have that sense of theater and drama and occasion. And I love the fact that a naturally aspirated engine, it's still doing that. And moreover, a naturally aspirated engine is such an endangered species now that it makes sense for it to kind of live on in lightweight performance cars. And I think if you've driven an 86 or a BRZ in anger, you know that you can be going quite slow and yet you've got the biggest grin on your face because it's not about how fast you're going, it's about how much fun you're having. And in a country like Australia where our speed limits are prohibitively low anyway, what more can you want? So the idea of having a 200 kilowatt turbocharged 0-105 second Toyota 86 and Subaru BRZ just kind of makes me gasp that it's completely defeating the purpose of that vehicle. And if it's true that they've decided to stick with the tried and true formula, despite, you know, requests from enthusiasts, I actually reckon that's awesome. And I commend them for that.
What about you, Joe? Sure. Would you prefer a turbo in these cars?
I think that, you know, I'm very much a person that likes to stick with tradition and acknowledge history in the best possible way. And I think that these cars really try to stay true to, you know, the 80s and 90s, where that's the kind of vehicle that people wanted. And there's probably a lot of people from that generation of car buyer that want something like that now, but they can't find it anywhere. And, you know, in the case of the MX-5 is quite small and impractical and, you know, for what it is, probably on a little bit more on the expensive side, whereas the 86 and the BRZ have proven to be quite good as entry-level sports cars, maybe not performance cars, so to speak, but sports cars. You know, Scott Colley used to own a Subaru BRZ. I know I have plenty of friends that and have met people through the ownership, car ownership circles that have owned or own one of these cars. And I think that they do a job, or they fit a gap in the market that not many players really participate in. And I would actually argue, Moco, that the people that are complaining that the BRZ and 86 aren't turbocharged are not actually enthusiasts. They're just like that modern car buyer that wants something that is fast and that looks good, as opposed to something that really makes you feel alive and is a really pure mechanical traditional driving experience. And I think that's something that a lot of brands are starting to shy away from because it's such a small customer base in the big scheme of things. But the fact that, you know, Mazda, Subaru and Toyota are still maintaining that there's a place for these inexpensive, fun to drive little sports cars that make you grin from ear to ear without actually blasting you to the horizon in 0 to 100 or in 3 or 4 or 5 seconds. You know, everyone's thinking about 0 to 100 times, but who's launching from 0 to 100 from the lights? Like, I'd really like to know. There is absolutely no road here that you're going to be testing that out on a daily basis. Like, why do people need that? Everyone, like, I just don't understand why everyone's like, I'm at the 0 to 100 times 6 seconds. That's slow. Like, people say that to me about my golf all the time. And it's like, well, it's not about that. Like, who the hell's driving like that? You, anyway, that's a story. That's a James Wong rant for another day.
It's one of my favorite car sayings is it's way more fun driving a slow car fast than a fast car slow.
Absolutely.
And it could be more true for these cars.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, yeah, as I said, I don't think they're actually enthusiasts. They're just little kids that want something that's a coupe and not a hatchback, and they want to stand out a little bit. Like, just go buy a Golf, kids, or go buy an i30N or something. Like, now that there's an auto, because most of these people wouldn't even be driving a manual anyway. So, like, this car is for, like, actual purists and enthusiasts. It's not for little kids who want to just drag you from the lights and res delete and make pops and bangs down Chapel Street when they go for a coffee and pumpkin spice latte and all that nonsense. Anyway.
Oh, you've really nailed that demographic perfectly.
Unfortunately, I'm in that age group and in that demographic. I just try my hardest to not be that person, if that makes sense. So, you know, here I am I constantly get chastised for not optioning leather seats in my Golf GTI within, you know, friendship groups. And I'm like, how dare you disrespect me in such a way? Like, I am not your kind of person.
Oh, my God. Well, if you agree or disagree with our thoughts on that topic, let us know. podcast@carexpert.com.au. Moco, September V-Facts, the new car sales figures were out this week, and it's still not looking all that promising, is it?
Surprise, surprise. So sales of new cars fell by just under 22% for September compared to the same month in 2019. That's just under 70,000 cars, so 68,985 to be precise. That brings the year-to-date tally to just under 650,000, which is down 20% on last year. And there have been 30 consecutive months of decreasing sales relative to the same month in the previous year. It was business as usual at the top end, with Toyota, Mazda and Hyundai occupying the podium, though interestingly enough, Kia was really knocking on the door. And normality also resumed in terms of top models, with the Ranger and the Hilux returning to the top of the charts. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the main driver of the sales reduction was Victoria, because, of course, Melbourne is currently under stage 4 lockdown due to the COVID outbreak down here, and so the dealerships have been closed across the metropolitan area. So unsurprisingly, sales fell by just under 60% in Victoria. So the vast majority of the downward trend is coming coming from Victoria, although New South Wales and Queensland are also slightly down this year. On a more positive note, though, Western Australia, the Northern Territory and the ACT are actually growing in sales. So we are seeing some green shoots, I guess, as it were.
Any interesting little miscellaneous facts that you found for last month?
Oh, so many miscellaneous facts, and I could spend hours on it, as you well know. So SUVs accounted for 47% market share, so about half the cars bought were SUVs, the rest being passenger cars and light commercial vehicles that were about neck and neck. Sales of private cars, so just sales to everyday mums and pops, dropped by 10%, but business fleets declined by 25%, which is probably why the government is really pushing very hard in the latest budget to make sure that they're incentivizing business fleets to purchase vehicles and drive us out of this recession that we're in. Rental car sales tumbled by 70%, which is perhaps why the Mitsubishi ASX was so far down. And government purchases declined by about 30%. Petrol cars were the majority, about 40,000 cars. Diesel was just under 22,000 cars. Hybrid car sales, 4,400, up 110%. And electric cars, excluding Tesla, were up 5% as well. And the main sources of cars, well, the usual suspects, so Japan, Thailand, Korea, and Germany, but then China was the fifth biggest source of cars. 3,220 of the cars sold in September came from China, and that's up 72% on the same month last year. So this much mooted Chinese wave is really starting to begin.
Mocha, I was just having a look at some of the figures and I was very interested to see, as you said, the Chinese brands climbing up the sales charts, but also the Koreans. Like, even though Hyundai was quite a bit down on last year's result, Kia's been quite strong and is now within a couple of hundred units. And if you look at like the compact segments, they're pretty much dominating everything. Like in both the small passenger and small SUV classes, you've got Kia and Hyundai 1-2, and they just seem to be doing very well across the board. Do you think that we might see Kia, for example, crack the top three as a more permanent rule moving forward?
I have a hard time. So a couple of times this year, Kia has actually overtaken Hyundai. I think it's been 2 months out of this year, maybe three. And that's on the back of things like, obviously, they dominate in the light car segment with the Picanto and the Rio. The Cerato is becoming more and more popular. The Seltos is now one of the most popular light or small SUVs going around. But Hyundai has a cavalcade of new product coming over the next few months. You've got the Palisade, which is their big top-of-the-range SUV. Brand, or not brand new, but a heavily updated Santa Fe, heavily updated Kona, heavily updated i30. You know, you've got this huge plethora of models coming. So I suspect Hyundai will get a bit of a bump as well. But you might see the likes of Mitsubishi start to fall a bit further. So for the month, you had Toyota, Mazda, and Hyundai on top, Kia in fourth, just behind Hyundai. And then there was a bit of a gap to Ford, and then a bit of a gap again to Mitsubishi and Volkswagen. So I don't know if Kia is going to overtake Hyundai or Mazda, but Ford is so reliant on Ranger, so they're very vulnerable if the ute market were to go backwards. And Mitsubishi and Volkswagen and Nissan really are now falling well behind Kia, and I expect that gap to kind of grow as time goes by.
Marco, how did the RAV4 hybrid stack up? We know that's been storming the sales charts at the moment.
Yeah, so the RAV4's obviously been killing it. A lot more supply managed to hit the Australian market. Toyota had really one hand tied behind its back. It couldn't get anywhere near enough supply. The waiting list is reducing now. RAV4 overall was the number three vehicle for the month. So Ranger was number one with 3,700, Hilux with 3,600, and then RAV4, 2,400, up 42% on the same month last year. Far and away the top-selling SUV. And then the Hyundai i30 was the top-selling passenger car, just under 1,800 units. Well over half of all RAV4s sold now are hybrids, so there's absolutely no reduction in demand. And I don't know, if you've been reading the site, dear listener, you may have seen Al Bors did a story comparing hybrid and non-hybrid RAV4, and it's just a no-brainer to buy the hybrid one if you're going to. So that car is absolutely going from strength to strength, and I don't see that slowing down anytime soon.
Mocha, you mentioned Ford earlier, and even though they've been very reliant on Ranger, that model seems to still be increasing its sales and market share and doing very well. And Ford actually increased its sales last month, which is quite impressive given the climate and also the fact that they're relying on one model. Now that we're seeing them bring in the Puma, which we've reviewed and pretty much decided it's a pretty good car, and then we also have a new Escape coming, what do you think that that means for Ford looking forward?
Well, theoretically, Ford's doing exactly what it needs to do. So it's getting rid of passenger cars. The Mondeo's gone. All of the Focuses, bar the sporty ones, are gone. The Fiesta's gone, except for the sporty one. So it's got rid of all those slow-selling passenger cars, and it's got rid of the terrible EcoSport and replaced it with the much better Puma. It's replacing the Escape with a far better new option that also comes in plug-in hybrid, guys, as you know. So they're doing all the right things. The historical challenge for Ford has always been this inability to sell more than one type of car. So it used to be the Falcon company, then it was the Territory company, and now it's the Ranger company. And the Ranger, and Mustang, that's very true. I mean, the Ranger accounts for sort of 60 or 70% of its sales every month. So, and to its credit, it is continually updating that car. So we know we've got a new one coming at the end of the year called, I think it's the FX4 Max, right, Wongy? Correct me if I'm wrong there, but it's kind of got the Raptor's suspension in part, but it's still got a bit of a payload about it because it keeps the regular Ranger rear leaf suspension. So that's a really good bet. And they're doing a lot to keep that car really, really at the top of the game, even though it's getting on in years. I think the new Escape should do well. The challenge for Ford's going to be, you know, there's so many competitors out there, and for whatever reason, it's not on people's shopping list right now compared to Hyundai or Kia or Mitsubishi in the SUV market, and it must change that. But there's no doubt that it has the product to do so. So I'm hoping for good things from Ford.
Have you seen any word on what FCA has said about this month's VFAX numbers?
FCA, yeah. So there's obviously a few brands that fall under that umbrella. We've seen Alfa Romeo doing okay. So Alfa Romeo was Alfa Romeo is up 61% in for the month, which is pretty impressive, although it only sold 95 cars. So it's obviously quite easy to grow a lot when you're only selling a very small number of cars. Chrysler's really only got one car now, the 300. They only sold 14 of those, so it's almost irrelevant at this point. Fiat, likewise. The Fiat Ducato van's kicking along okay, but the Fiat 500's really starting to die quite a bit. Jeep is interesting, though. So we've seen Jeep sort of have this precipitous fall from a top 10 brand 5 or 6 years ago to being right, you know, well down on the list, getting outsold by the likes of MG month after month. But the company is starting to turn a corner. It's down 13% for the year, but that is less than the overall market rate. So it's actually grown its market share again this year. Grand Cherokee's hanging in there with the updated Compass recently launching, the new Wrangler Ute really turning a lot of heads, the Gladiator. There is a chance that company could turn things around a little bit, but it's going to be a slow battle for it.
Yeah. You can read the full VFAX report right now at carexpert.com.au. And if you have any questions, please leave them in the comments below. I'm sure you'd love to answer them, Mike.
Yeah, myself and Wongy are keeping on top of those. So please do feel free to hit it up on the site. And any questions you might have, just ask us and we'll get back to you.
We already know the Hyundai i30N is one mean machine, which is why we are pretty excited for the i20N when it comes to Australia next year. One lucky man got the chance to drive the prototype, and his name is Tony Crawford. Hello, Croft.
How are you?
Great.
I'm excited by this car. Look, it was kind of thrown in at the last minute. We were there to actually drive the i30N with dual clutch transmission. That's up on carexpert.com. You as well as a review, but they threw this sort of we've also got an i20N, which we're not getting for a while, but you might get some laps in that. So I really wasn't thinking twice about it, but anyway, look, I put about I'd say about 12 laps in two sessions on the i30N, which I literally thought was fantastic with that dual clutch. It's the best dual clutch that's not a PDK, put it that way, in my opinion. It just did everything you wanted it to. Now, the i20N is based on the European i20, which we don't get. It was always too expensive, I was told. You boys might know more about that but in a minute. But so the i20N is manual only, whereas, of course, the i30N is available, will be available with DCT and, of course, the standard manual transmission. Lap two in of about 10 laps in the i20N, I'm starting to think, Jesus, this thing is, I'm turning in so much later. I'm braking so much later. So down the straight, before you come, Wakefield Park has 10 corners. The last turn 10 onto the main straight, In the i30N, the original instruction was to start braking at 75 meters. I was braking between 50 and 40. And I thought even then I could leave it a bit later in the i30N. The i20N, I worked out yesterday talking with someone else at this Audi gig I've just been on, that I was actually braking at around 10 meters before the corner. That's how late you can leave the braking on this thing, because it only weighs like 1250 or 1295, 1250 or 1295, forgotten. But it is so agile, and there is so much grip from these Pirelli P0s that are bespoke to both the i30N and the i20N. I was just in phenomenal grip. And as Bierman said, and I put it in my review, it's just no longer about 0 to 100 times. It's just so irrelevant to the enjoyment of driving a car. It's not funny anymore. And this car, I think they're saying it's sort of 0 to 100 in sort of mid to high sixes, maybe seven. But it felt friggin' quick on track into these corners, because you could literally not brake. You just lift off a little bit and back on. The interior had the big screen, the big new screen that the i30's got. I think it's 10.1. So it was all there inside. We weren't allowed to show the inside for some strange reason.
You know? I was just going to say, how production ready do you think that is?
I'm not sure what you do to the car, or the i30N for that matter, with the D. I'm not sure anything is required. For me, I'd take it straight off the shelf now, both of those cars. But I started to think, I mean, I was preferring the i20N. Normally I love power, but I was just loving the handling aspects of this i20N. And I think it's going to be sold for, if they're smart, they'll put it at $29,900. Unless they've got some other amazing pricing strategy. But it's going to kill it. It's going
to
kill
it. So, Croft, just comparing this to i30N, obviously it's a smaller car. How much lighter is it than the i30N, and how much less power and torque does it have than the i30N?
Okay, I think it's – I don't have the exact figures, but I'm thinking it's around 200 kilos less. Right. I think the i30 weighs 14-something, 1450, 1460. I'm not sure. That's my guess, but this definitely weighs under 1300. Power-wise, this thing's got – they didn't have the exact figures. Here's the thing, being a prototype. They're talking 150 kilowattish and 275 newton meter-ish, which is
from
actually,
1.6, right?
Yeah, from a 1.6 turbo petrol, whereas the Fiesta's got 147 and 290 from another three-pot engine, and the Golf has got 147 and 320. So the Polo GDI has got quite a bit more torque. And the Yaris, of course, well, that's in it. I think the Yaris GR is in another league, isn't it? Like, it's 200 kilowatts and 370 newton meters. And it's probably going to be 50 grand, aren't they? Are they talking when it becomes retail? I know they have the 40 grand drive away job. But everyone else is, I don't see how that's going to work. Everyone's paid that got in early 40 grand drive away. And what, other people are going to come in and pay another 10?
So, Croft, you said before you dropped the name Bierman, and just to clarify for our listeners, that's Albert Bierman, who is now the head of the R&D division of Hyundai. He was the guy that really drove the growth of the N brand. But before that, he was actually the head of the BMW M division. And when when he was running BMW M division, he never would have been able to tune a vehicle as small as the i20N, because, of course, the smallest car he would have worked on would have been the M versions of the 1 Series, which is a much bigger car, much more i30 size than i20 size. So you get the sense that Bierman has always wanted to play and calibrate a tiny, almost rally homologated pocket rocket like this, and he's never had the chance before now. Does it kind of feel like a passion project in that sense?
Yeah, 100%. Look, everything's been done to this thing. Suspension system's got new knuckle springs, dampers. It's a beefed up chassis for a start. The brakes have been beefed up, 40 mil increase on those. I don't think you'd ever go. I mean, this car and the i30N were both hammered. There was only two cars, right? So they got hammered from morning till dusk at Wakefield Park, which is heavy on brakes, heavy on tyres. It's a small track by comparison. comparison to Eastern Creek, say, but this card never even looked like fading, and everyone was getting into it at all sorts of driving styles and was really getting abused, let's say. And everyone said the same thing. They thought they might lean towards the I-20N if they were putting their own money down because of the fun factor. You go back and forth, right? When you hop into the I-30N, you love the power, you love the DCT, then suddenly you get into manual and think, oh, it's so good to drive a manual, but this is so good. We don't care about the power because it turns in quicker than the I-30N, you know?
Well, isn't this incredible now that we have these choices? Because historically, they've always had the small car-based hot hatches that have been there to choose from, your Golf GDI and your Focus ST and your all those different models. But now you've also got this incredible proliferation of tiny, tiny city cars with really powerful turbo engines. And you mentioned them before, right? So it's the Yaris GR, it's the Polo GDI, it's the Fiesta ST and the i20N. All of them are incredibly fun in their own different ways. Now, you've spent quite a bit of time driving hot hatches over the years. In the pantheon of hot hatches that you've experienced, Croft, how high is that i20N in that list? Is it? It sounds like it's almost right up the very top.
I reckon it is, yeah. If the Bierman thing, I've been a huge fan of this guy. I interviewed him when we drove a prototype of i30N manual at the farm in New South Wales. I've known the guy probably for about 9 years. You just get the impression that the guy's a total perfectionist, which is why it's taken 3 years to get a DCT for the i30N, right? And now we've got – I don't think the i20N will end up with a DCT, by the way, because it will ruin the power-to-weight ratio, which I think this thing excels on. I just can't wait for you guys and the public to get a drive of these cars because they are – I mean, when the i30N came out with manual, it literally destroyed the Golf GDI on track, right? It was not even in the same league. Again, the Golf GDI was probably the better daily car, well, without hesitation really, because it was more comfortable. The i30N was quite a firm thing and is quite a firm thing. I think they've done a bit of work on the suspension with the new i30N coming out with DCT, so I think you'll find – this will be a really good test for JWO to get into this car and just rate it against his own Golf GDI. Well, at least when the Mark 8 comes out. When is that out, the Mark 8?
First quarter next year.
Yeah. GDI coming out with it?
Yeah, GCI and normal models coming next year in Q1, and then the R will be here in the third quarter.
Oh, you've got to try and get up to Queensland with that, Cohen. We need to see what the journos do against an ATCO.
Well, this is
he needs some pressure put on him. Moko, I want to challenge that guy in the DCT. I get close to ATCO in the DCT. At even QR, I don't even know that track, but Wakefield Park, let's get him down there because I challenge that I can go close to ATCO at Wakefield Park.
Croft, I love you. So, you know that. I've loved you for years, but I'm telling you right now, ATCO could get in my Suzuki Jimny and he would beat you around a track if you were in the i20N.
I can't accept it, Mocha.
He's a World Rally Championship driver, mate.
I know, mate. I know. This car, I've not driven a Fiesta ST recently. The latest model, so I'm not able. It was always a very firm car, so it's very hard to talk about what's better. But engineering wise, I would say that Bierman would not, and this car might be improved, right, before it actually gets to a full production series vehicle. So it may be tweaked even further on the basis of what everyone said about it. Because I know Europe drove this car, European journos drove this car about the same time we drove it last week, and he will listen to that feedback. He seems the type of guy to listen to feedback, even though he has, you know, decades of experience in making what some of the best M cars ever made. Is what they say about Bierman. Can't wait for you guys to drive it.
No, we can't either. Croft's review is now live at the site if you want to go and check it out. Tony Crawford, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. It's been great to talk to you.
If you're after an SUV with a bit of personality and character, the Kia Seltos and Jeep Compass could be your ticket. And it just so happens, Moko, you've compared the two. Why did you put these two back to back?
Well, I think it's a question that very few people are probably asking themselves, and that makes it interesting to me. So the Seltos is one of the most popular small SUVs going around, and in my opinion, it's the best small SUV going around, certainly at its price point. But not many people really consider the Jeep Compass. Worldwide, it's Jeep's most popular vehicle. It claims that it is anyhow. But in Australia, it doesn't even have 1% market share. So it's really kind of a bit of a forgotten contender here. You know, people buy Mitsubishi ASXs and they buy, you know, at the higher end, Audi Q3s. They don't really buy Jeep Compasses. So I thought it would be really nice to sort of establish where does this Jeep sit in the pantheon, and what better to put it up against than the Kia Seltos. So the Jeep that I tested was the second from top in the spec pantheon, called the S Limited. It's priced at $46,000 before on-road costs, which means you're paying about 50 grand drive away, which is, you know, nudging that Audi Q3 entry point. The Kia is a much more affordable offering, so it's $42,990 drive away is tested in the GT line, guys, which is the absolute top of the range. So a little bit of a price gap. The Jeep is commanding a premium, and I wanted to know, is that just because of the Jeep badge, or is there something a bit more substantive that you're getting for the money?
I was just going to say, what do you get for the money? Which car has the most amount of tech?
Well, they're both relatively loaded up. So both get privacy glass, a sunroof, although if you get the contrasting roof color in the Kia like my test car had, you don't get the sunroof, but it is standard at this level. Proximity key fob, rain sensing wipers, you know, big touch screens with heated leather seats, climate control, sat nav, you know, digital radio, the works. But the Kia does offer more equipment. So the Jeep does have bigger wheels and it does have a electric tailgate, but the Kia has LED headlights instead of by xenons. It has a 10.25-inch touchscreen versus an 8.4. It has ventilated front seats, a head-up display, and a wireless phone charger. So when it comes to tech, the Kia does definitely sit above the Jeep. And in terms of safety, they're both relatively well-equipped. So they've both got, six airbags in the Kia and seven in the Jeep because it adds the drive. Driver's airbag. Both have forward autonomous emergency braking, blind spot monitoring, and lane keeping aids that worked actively, rear cross traffic alert, and active cruise control. But the Kia's AEB is more advanced because it can detect cyclists and pedestrians as well. And it also has something called the safe exit alert that tells you if there's a bike approaching, if you're going to open your door when you're parked in a parallel bay. So if you don't do that Dutch reach maneuver, it can potentially save a life. So there's no doubt that the Kia is both about 7 grand cheaper and drive away than the Jeep unless you get a deal, and also significantly better equipped as well. So probably not a great start for the Jeep.
The styling with both of them are so very different. Which one do you think is the better looker?
Yeah, well, Jeep's definitely gone for a bit of a sort of mini Grand Cherokee design language for the Compass. It's got that very rugged, you know, absolutely unmistakable Jeep look, that slotted seven slot, you know, grille at the front. There's no other brand that's doing that. And so I think it looks great. You know, the S Limited has black wheels and a contrasting black roof. It's really tough. There's a Trailhawk version that sits even higher up the range. It sits higher up off the ground and has proper off-road tech in it. But even so, you know, as far as these small SUVs go, I reckon that the Jeep is probably the best looker out there. Although the Kia, you know, again, a lot of small SUVs kind of have a bit of a try-hard design about them, I find. But the Kia is quite a sensible design with some really nice touches, but it's got a big macho boxy design to it as well. So these are two of the more, I guess, square, edgy, macho designs in the class. There's nothing particularly sporty about the way they look. But, it, you know, in terms of which one's going to be more impressive in your driveway, no doubt the Jeep.
Moco, clearly one of the biggest roles that a car has is to drive you from A to B. So given that the Jeep and the Kia have different approaches in terms of their drivetrains, how did they differ on the road?
Yeah, so quite different engines. So the top of the range Jeep Compass Trailhawk has a diesel engine, but everything else uses a 2.4-litre naturally aspirated petrol engine with 129 kilowatts and 229 newton metres, and that's mated to a 9-speed automatic transmission and an all-wheel drive system with a locking mode that can fix the torque flow front to rear, 10.1 seconds to 100 k's and 9.7 litres every 100 k's of fuel use claimed, although in the real world I was averaging 12, which is pretty thirsty for a small SUV. The Seltos GT line has a 1.6-litre turbo engine with 130 kilowatts, so same power as the Jeep, but 265 newton metres of torque, so a fairly decent slab of torque over and above the Jeep from a lower point in the rev band. And it's mated to a 7-speed dual-clutch automatic that gives you not quite as much smoothness off the line, but is much quicker shifting once you're up and running. The fuel economy is 7.6, so 25% better fuel economy, and the 0 to 100 time is 8 seconds, so, you know, 2 seconds faster to 100 than the Jeep. So when it comes to the engines, you know, the Kia manages to be both more efficient and faster. So, you know, when it comes to performance, it would be quite hard to say that the Kia doesn't win easily.
Marco, you're a fairly tall guy. How did you find the space in the cabin in front and the rear seats?
Well, some small SUVs are ridiculously compact inside. You know, the Toyota CHR and Hyundai Kona come to mind as vehicles that really, you know, you're only putting kids in the back. But these two are actually quite practical. So I'm 194 centimetres and I was on the borderline of comfort in the back seats of both. But I would say that I'm an outlier, and I would say that any adult in 180 centimetres or below average size would be fine. Now, the Kia is a bit better because it's a bit easier to see out from the back seats. The Jeep's got this quite small rearmost window between the C and D pillars. But in terms of comfort and in terms of space, very, very similar. And these are two of the bigger, small SUVs. In fact, these cars really sit on the borderline between what you define as a small and a mid-sized SUV. The only practicality point that the Kia has is that underneath the boot, it has a full-size spare wheel, whereas the Jeep has a space saver, even though the boots are very similar in size. So you'd say practicality-wise, the Kia just takes the edge, but there's not a heap in it.
All right, so Mocha, you've gone through the powertrains and performance, but actually, how about how they actually drive?
Yeah, so this is where they really diverge. So the Kia is definitely it puts the sport in sports utility vehicle. It's a very, very nippy little thing. It actually is quite a tenacious handler, very car-like, has that local Australianized suspension tune that works really well, independent suspension at both ends, nice grippy tires, good brakes. Body control stays really flat through corners. It sits lower to the ground than the Jeep does, and it really feels it. It's got a sports mode that adds resistance to the steering and tells the gearbox to hold lower gears a bit longer to really sort of amplify that performance feeling. You know, if you see yourself at a roundabout, you can really hook in the Kia, and it tucks in beautifully. And it's got this quite it's obviously a reactive on-demand all-wheel drive system, but it's quite quick to send torque to the rear if needed. That DCT is obviously a performance-oriented gearbox. So it feels like a high-riding hot hatchback in a lot of ways. The Jeep doesn't feel like that. It's a bit, I guess, there's a bit more roll through corners. You sit up a little bit higher. It's got 19-inch wheels, which means at low speeds, you feel a bit more of that pitter-patter through your seat, you know, over sharp hits and cobbles and potholes and things like that. It's a little bit more fidgety than the Kia is. But where the Jeep really shines is off-road. Now, most people buying these sorts of cars don't really bother with off-roading, but even the S Limited, which doesn't have the low-range gearing and the underbody bash plates that you find in the Trailhawk, is still quite competent off-road. I tackled a loggy hill, I tackled some offset moguls, sort of sandy and muddy tracks, and the Jeep really did walk all over that, whereas the Kia, you know, barely even made a dent. So if you are somebody that actually does soft roading, the Jeep is clearly the one to go for. I think, though, the Trailhawk, which is the next level up, is even better off-road. That's actually an absolute, and it's trail-rated. It's done the Rubicon. That's a proper 4x4. But, you know, as far as these soft roaders go, the Jeep is definitely more soft road ready. The Kia is definitely more road biased. So for me, given what I know the average buyer wants to do with these, which is they're essentially just urban hatchbacks, the Kia is going to make more sense for more people. There's no doubt about it. I think the Jeep really is a bit of a niche offering, but it was really worth revisiting the car to remind myself what it was like. You know, the lowest review that I ever gave a car at my previous place of employee, Car Advice, was to the Jeep Compass, the previous generation. It was the worst, meanest review that I ever wrote, and it was richly deserved. And I can very much say that this new one is a heck of a lot better than that. And it's actually quite good in some ways. It falls short in others. It's not as good a value as the Kia. It's not as comfortable as the Kia. It's not as sporty as the Kia. But at least it has a couple of USPs that its predecessor didn't. So I'd be taking the Kia, but it's not a ridiculous proposition to look at that Jeep. I just think it needs to be a little bit cheaper for what it is.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, Moko. I think that the Jeep brand has been built on adventure and off-roading, and I think having a road-biased Jeep, you really need to have something that stands out. I think the Trailhawk is a great unique option because there aren't a lot of vehicles in that segment that can really do tough off-roading, and I think that that kind of satisfies a hole in the market where it can do road bias duties while also being able to do handle a proper trail, as which is why they name it trail rated. But I think at that price point, and clearly, as you say, it's not separated in terms of ability well enough from the main competitor set to really be as convincing as it could be. So Yeah.
And on terms of price, I would just point out that, you know, sometimes Jeeps fall victim to exchange rates because they come out of the United States. But this Jeep is made at FCA's very impressive factory in India. So the Indian plant is what makes right-hand drive versions of the Compass. Don't think that means that the car isn't well made, because the interior is actually good quality and there's no reason to doubt the actual build of it. But when it's coming out of India, which is obviously a cheaper place to make vehicles than the US is, geographically a bit closer, already in right-hand drive, there are fewer reasons for that price to be premium. So for me, I think that's even more reason why this car just needs to be ever so slightly adjusted. And if they can get that price down just a little bit, it actually becomes a much more compelling proposition than it currently is.
Click carexpert.com.au to read more on those two models. And that brings an end to this week's podcast. For anyone who hasn't caught up on the site this week, JoWo, is there anything that's worth highlighting?
Well, we've had a couple of big launches happen over the last 48 hours. So the all-new Mazda BT50 launch review has gone live, written by Kurt Dupree. And Kurt Dupree has also done a Skoda Kamiq launch review. So two very important cars for their respective brands, but also very different in terms of their concept and execution. Obviously, we've done a lot of work around the Isuzu D-Max, which the BT50 shares its platform with. So it's very interesting to read the similarities and differences there. And then the Skoda Kamiq is a new area of the market for Skoda. It's now in the light / compact SUV segment. So it's basically a Volkswagen T-Cross dressed up in Skoda clothes and has a nicer interior. But, you know, it's a bit of a left of field choice. So two very interesting vehicles that I'm sure a lot of people will be wanting to know about.
Yeah, awesome. What cars have we got in all the garages next week, Marco?
We've got some really great cars in our garages, Mandy. So we've got the Mercedes-Benz A250e, which is the plug-in hybrid version of the new A-Class. Next week, I've got Kurt doing a comparison test of the new D-Max X-Terrain versus the Ranger Wildtrak. So a long overdue twin test there. We've got the new Mercedes-Benz GLB 35 through the garage. We've got a Volkswagen T-Roc down here in Melbourne, as well as a Kia Sorento Sport Plus. There's a Range Rover Velar hitting the Sydney garage. So a really nice mix, actually, of vehicles. Obviously, we've been a bit quieter on press cars, especially down here in Melbourne. But fingers crossed, from late October, if you know, restrictions start to lift a little bit, we'll be able to fill out that calendar a bit more. But still some pretty interesting stuff in there.
No, really awesome week ahead. And if you're listening to this and you're loving the show, please give us a rating on whatever podcast platform you're on. We would really appreciate it. In the meantime, Mike Costello and James Wong, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks for having me, Mandy. Always a pleasure.